Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests today are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tony Hall of Alaska Newspapers, and joining us from Washington, Libby Casey of APRN. Paul, big surprise right at airtime on Friday. Vic Coring will get a new trial, that is convicted legislator Vic Coring, who was out on appeal.
A three-judge panel at the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this morning agreed that the government had withheld information from defense lawyers during Coring's trial. And two judges said, well, let's just overturn the sentence. A third judge said that it was so egregious, the federal government's prosecutorial misconduct, that they ought to dismiss the indictment as well. That didn't happen. What will happen at this point is anybody's guess whether the federal government will go ahead with a retrial, Mr. Coring. And the only question I think left for Alaskans is, when is he going to announce he's running for office again?
And that could, and there's many people who think he would.
Yeah, I'm guessing he will.
There also would be questions about other people who were convicted. Pete Cott also has an appeal. I think that's the only other appeal at the
still
present time.
Out
but
there,
we're
right?
still, and also Representative, former Representative Bruce Weirach goes to trial in May and June, and there probably will be questions about that as well.
As well, this is far from over. It's one of those things that went bad early on, and it's just gotten worse as time goes on.
Let's go to Washington for Libby Casey. Libby, Democrats and Republicans are at somewhat of a war, especially in the Senate, over the federal budget for the rest of this fiscal year. What's the latest scene you've seen there? There have been a number of votes, and what do you hear from our delegation?
That's right. Well, unless a budget compromise is reached, the federal government shuts down on March 18th. Now, House Republicans announced today that they are coming up with a new temporary spending plan. The president at a press conference today basically voiced his support for having a short-term stopgap, if you will, as a bigger spending plan is hammered out. The big votes this week were in the Senate. Republicans put forth this House plan that would cut $57 billion from the budget, and it's got a lot of controversial things in it, including public broadcasting defunding, cuts to Planned Parenthood, essentially cutting out the regulations for the health care law and environmental regulations, cutting out the enforcement of those. Republicans voted for that, almost all in the Senate, except for a couple Tea Party guys who said it didn't go far enough. Lisa Murkowski voted for it, even though she said she wouldn't have written it that way, and there are things she really didn't like in it, like the cuts to public broadcasting and the cuts to Planned Parenthood. But she said you've got to start somewhere, and this is part of that negotiating process. The Democrats had a bill that would have cut about $6 or $7 billion from the budget. Senator Begich voted for that one, also saying you have to start somewhere. So now the question is where the middle line will be, how close they'll be able to come to that center area. What Begich and other Democrats are saying is don't play politics here. Don't go after ideological missions like these Planned Parenthood issues and such. Let's just try to do things like take care of the efficiencies in government, get rid of duplication in the government. A big GAO report just came out last week saying that there's a lot of duplication in federal government that could save save a lot of money. So we're going to see how the spending battle plays out over the next week or so.
Okay, thank you very much. Tony, Alaska tribes claimed a second major victory in the sovereignty victory in courts, second major victory within the last few months. The issue, who has jurisdiction over custody of tribal members, especially minors? Tell us what you know from the perspective of Alaska newspapers.
Well, Michael, last week the state Supreme Court made a decision in a case that's been on the docket since 2004. Tanana versus State involves Tanana and five other villages from western Alaska and also on the Kenai Peninsula, basically asking for rights for recognition for tribal courts. This stems from a decision or an order by then attorney, State Attorney General Greg Reinkes in 2004, ordering state agencies to stop recognizing tribal court decrees. So what the court said, the state Supreme Court said in its limited decision was Alaska Native tribes are not necessarily precluded from exercising sovereign jurisdiction to initiate child custody proceedings. There are a number of other things that it did not rule on, but attorneys for the Native American Rights Fund took this as a victory and a sign for good things in the future.
Can you tell us anything about the specifics of the child who was involved and the specifics of the case?
Well, it was a broader case that was addressing Ranke's decision 2004.
Rather than a particular individual?
There was a couple in Fairbanks that was a party to the case as
plaintiffs.
Well. They were plaintiffs. They joined the Native villages who were in the case, and they had adopted a special needs child from Tanana, and had ongoing problems with getting state agencies to cooperate with them. And what the Native American Rights Fund points out in this situation, and legislators have pointed out as well last year, is that there's a lot of services in rural Alaska that are not immediately available, and tribal courts help fill a gap in state services. And they're looking at this as an opportunity going forward to have a dialogue with the state about this Renke's decision that's still on the books.
Okay. Paul, let's go back to you and let's talk gas line. The Denali Gas Line Pipeline Project is going to miss a deadline. Could you tell us a little bit more about who Denali is for those who have missed it or weren't here? It's been an ongoing project for quite a while. And tell us what it means to miss this deadline.
Well, Denali Gas Pipeline is a conglomeration of BP and ConocoPhillips. It was their answer to the state's AGEA program, which they really weren't allowed to join in with. AGEA, of course, would be TransCanada and Exxon. They have the state's license, if you will, and $500 million of the state's money to proceed with a FERC certification so they can build a pipeline at some point. The private interest in this, BP and Conoco, said, well, we'll start our own, the Denali pipeline. They set a self-imposed deadline of the end of the first quarter to have a contract signed, have shippers on board, which you need so that you can go to financiers and get money to pay for line. Well, apparently the negotiations are more complex than they thought. They're taking longer than they thought. Gas markets have changed. Shale has come online in the past year. New technology is surfacing every day to make shale more easily available. I think they're having to take a stop and take another look at the profitability and viability of this gas line.
If I may, isn't this, in many respects, a microcosm of what's been the problem for the Trans-Alaska gas line all along, just the kind of things you've cited?
Exactly. The market, when you're building a pipeline, they're talking about it. If they built a pipeline starting today, it would probably be 2020 before anybody would have anything looking like a pipeline out there. But in 10 years, look how much has changed in the last 10 years. 5 or 6 years ago, gas was $13, $14 per cubic thousand feet. Today it's $3 or $4 or $5. It's hard to guess. And I think they're taking their time. And we've also got the other problem of fiscal certainty, which is going to have to be settled by the state.
That's the tax regimen.
The tax regimen. How much are you going to charge me? They're going to ask the state. So I can figure what it's going to cost to ship gas through that line. We don't know. Nobody knows at this point. So it's difficult to come up with those magic numbers, especially in a kind of a changing market like this.
In a certain sense, it puts the AGEA process in a different light, reminding people that an alternative would be very different.
Well, it would be very different. And another thing is the TransCanada missed its deadline at the end of the year as well. So this is a lot of it going around, apparently.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Tony Hall, and from Washington, D.C., Libby Casey. Paul, at the risk of bad punning, the cell phone bill is driving through the House of Representatives. And it looks like the legislature might pass a bill that will limit use of cell phone while you're on the road.
Well, there were four. This is a staple of talk radio now. Everybody, of course, can talk on the cell phone and drive safely. What is the matter with you? That's where we're at. We started off with four bills in the legislature, in the House, to trim back driving and talking on the cell phone. Some banned it out. One of them banned it outright. They had different mixes of what you could do and could not do with a cell phone. What we wound up with is a bill that says if you're younger than 18, you're not talking on the cell phone at all. If you're older than 18, It's hands-free talking on the cell phone. You can't hold the cell phone in your hand and manipulate it while you drive. So that's where we are now. I don't know how it's going to do in the Senate. I'm not sure that there's going to be. There are a lot of legislators very, very leery of this. They see it as infringement on personal privacy, personal rights.
And I think I've heard that phrase, you can have my cell phone when you
pry it from my, yeah, exactly.
My cold dead hand
or something.
Pull it
out, yeah, right.
Okay, Paul, thank you. Libby, let's go to you. This is a big story in Washington, and it has effects for Alaska. NPR is in a lot of trouble with Congress after some senior executives, or at least one, said some very inopportune things to people who are engaged in what amounts to a sting, trying to expose their, quote, liberal bias, unquote. This was conducted by a group of conservative activists who have done this kind of thing before. The publicity, I think, from NPR's standpoint and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was virtually all bad. What does this mean for NPR, and what could it mean for Alaska?
Right. Well, NPR CEO Vivian Schiller was forced by the board of NPR to step down this week after that footage came to light. And as you said, it was a setup to capture another executive, the top fundraiser for NPR, who had actually already given his resignation to go take a different job, so he was already out the door. But he made comments that were disparaging towards conservatives, and also he said that NPR would be better off in the long run without federal funding. That phrase has been really picked up by Republicans in Washington who are eager to try to cut funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Now, it's important to distinguish NPR, National Public Radio, from all of public broadcasting. NPR does not get a lot of its money from federal funds, but small stations, for example, those in Alaska, public radio, public TV stations, do get a lot of their money from federal dollars through grants and things like that. And so NPR is on the chopping block. Public broadcasting is on the chopping block right now, under scrutiny, not only because of this latest incident, but because everybody's looking for places to cut money. Now, the president in his press conference today actually gave a little shout out to public broadcasting and sort of said, like, that's like small potatoes. We need to be looking at the big ways to save money in this country. But when I talked to the Alaska delegation, they are very supportive of public broadcasting in Alaska. However, Senators Murkowski and Begich both said brace for cuts because nationally they believe public broadcasting will take a hit because Senator Begich said everything's going to take a hit. And so did Senator Murkowski. Programs that they really like and appreciate, like the LIHEAP program that gives help to low-income folks for heating assistance, all the way down the line. And so they're saying across the board, get ready. Now, it's interesting because Senator Stevens, the late Senator Stevens, was a huge proponent of public broadcasting, both in Alaska and nationally, not just here in the state. And so people in Washington are looking to the Alaska delegation in particular, and especially Senator Murkowski as a Republican, to see if she will step into those shoes and be one of those Republicans who still is a big advocate of public broadcasting. She says she is, but it's not just a matter of protecting the Alaska interests, it's the national money that helps keep the Alaska stations on the air.
So Libby, we'll if I might, Senator Murkowski obviously is in a different position than Senator Stevens was. He was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee and could put things in the budget when he wanted to and take them out. She's not in that kind of position at all. And it seemed to me Murkowski was very interesting. She said this sting by James O'Keefe and his friends doesn't help. It just makes her job harder. But I also get the impression that our delegation is trying to distinguish between good public broadcasting, which is out helping Alaskans, particularly those who can't afford it and need federal help, versus bad public broadcasting, which is, I don't know what, bureaucrats in Washington?
Well, I think they are trying to make some separation there. You're right, between Alaska, and they say it brings people everything from the weather to important crucial reports, like, for example, in the Aleutians this morning, letting people know the tsunami danger. That's public broadcasting system versus some of the big city stations down the lower 48. But it's not that easy to untwine the strings, right? It's a lot more tied together. And so it's a matter of sort of that put your money where your mouth is moment where they're going to have to make some decisions about how they support it nationally, because that will affect things back in Alaska. You're right, though, Michael. I mean, not only do we not have an Alaskan member of Congress who's at the top of a big committee like appropriations, but those positions don't really even matter so much anymore because all bets are off. Appropriations just is not as powerful as it used to be.
That's very true, because, and even Ted Stevens, were he around as chairman of the Appropriations, would have to face up to that. That's very true. I had obtained a list of communities that receive help from the federal government for public broadcasting, and there probably are more than 10 that receive 35% to something like 70% of their funding from the federal government. Let's go to Tony Hall from these forms of grants to them, to broadcasting. Tony, thanks to some shuffling of committee assignments, Mark Begich, Senator Mark Begich, a first-term Democrat, has now taken control of an important U.S. Senate subcommittee. Tell us about his new role and what we might expect from him here in Alaska.
Well, Michael, the subcommittee is called the Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard Subcommittee. And
thanks for a pretty ugly acronym.
I hate to have it on my business card, but that's what Mark has now. And we talked with him last week when he was in Anchorage about his goals on this committee as a chairman. This was a committee that Senator Stevens had sat on. His immediate goals deal with funding for NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. There's another mouthful, and with baseline funding for the Coast Guard. Some of the things with NOAA involve Arctic orbiting satellites, dealing with weather forecasting, but this week when he had his first hearing, he went straight to fisheries, and he did bring up, he invited a speaker from Juneau with the Fish at Sea Processors Association to deal with the catch shares issue, which is basically how the harvest of fish is
divided. And if I might, isn't this the realm of how do you make everybody happy with these fishery shares?
It is, and some people say Mark's going to learn a few lessons in his new position as chairman, because there are a lot of people in Alaska that don't like, as they call it, the privatization of the sea through catch shares. So, but that's where he chose to. He is supporting it. He likes the idea of catch shares. He sees it just like with any resource, you have to manage it. And catch shares is a vehicle to do that. He just, when he spoke with the head of NOAA, said that no new programs. Let's work with what we have on the books right now.
Well, it may also, from a political perspective, be better to make stake out a clear position rather than try to straddle several positions.
Sure, that's right.
Okay, Paul, the cost overruns at the Matsu prison keep troubling legislators. I'm wondering, and the numbers are staggering, whether it's for 1 year or the life of the project, a prison that the builders couldn't finish. And I'm wondering if what we're really faced with here is another version of too big to fail, and that the state of Alaska is going to have to come in here. What do you think?
This is not good. This is a tough one for them. It's going to be it's a $240 million prison, and they're getting close to finally getting ready to turn the lights on in the thing. And they discover, it's $70 million a year to run this thing, and $22 million to mothball it. So we'd be smarter to leave our prisoners outside rather than bring them back here at $20 million, pay the $22 million in rent and fees every year, and we'll come out ahead. Well, somebody's going to have to pick that up, and that's where they are now. The Senate Finance Committee is like, what?
And the spectacle of this half-finished dungeon
exactly,
out in the Matsu
exactly.
Borough.
We prefer to think of it as the new state capital, but that's neither here nor there. It's the Senate Finance has demanded an audit by January so they can have some idea of what's and where's, and maybe they can figure out what to do with this thing. But if
the audit's going to take a number of months, wouldn't that argue against them doing anything this fiscal year?
They probably won't do anything right away. I don't know if they know what to do. I'm not sure they understand the scope of the problem yet. It's one of those
things. There are a group of constituents who know what to do, which would be write the check.
Exactly.
Right?
That's what they're talking about, yeah. There's talk about giving it over, selling it, leasing it, doing something to a private company. I think they're just now, trying to figure out what are we going to do, what are our options, and I think
Do you think this could be a campaign issue for Vic Coring?
No, of course not. Vic will come back, he'll take it, I tell you.
That is an interesting thing, finding out Vic Coring's position on the prison.
On the prison.
Let's go to Libby Casey in Washington once again. Libby, Senator Lisa Murkowski has been very busy in the last few days. She's been very active. First, she was questioning Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano about what happened to Sharon Cisna in Juneau with the TSA. And this week she had, yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder in front of her committee, or the committee she serves on, discussing the Bill Allen case. So what, maybe we should do Allen first and Eric Holder first and then go back to Representative Cisna.
Sure. It's like the Obama administration rock star time right now on Capitol Hill, because after the president put out his new budget proposal for next year, his top officials, his cabinet members, come to the Hill and testify and talk about the budget. It's a great chance, though, for members of Congress like Senators Murkowski, Begich, Congressman Young, to take that FaceTime with them and put forth issues that are maybe not so much related to the budget, but might be related to other things that are sort of burning in their minds. And so yesterday, as you mentioned, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, spoke before a Judiciary Appropriations Subcommittee. And Lisa Murkowski just lit right into it and said, you know, my thing I want to talk to you about is Bill Allen, who was this key witness, the former head of VICO, in the trial of former Senator Ted Stevens, in all these Alaska corruption cases. He took a plea deal, serving jail time right now. What Murkowski's wondering about is why hasn't he been indicted for sexual abuse of a minor? Because there are allegations, and there has been an investigation into mistreatment, sexual abuse of a 15-year-old girl that not only did Bill Allen allegedly abuse, but brought across state lines between Seattle and Alaska for prostitution purposes. And it has been investigated. Senator Murkowski says there's a lot of evidence and information here. Why has it gone nowhere? And her concern is, and she said Alaskans share her concern, is that it hasn't gone anywhere. Let's cut to the chase here, because Bill Allen's well connected and has been of use to the Justice Department and has all these sort of this power right now. Eric Holder said, we do not make decisions based on political connections or someone's usefulness or power. We make decisions based on the merit of the case and our ability to prosecute it. And so he reiterated that a couple of times.
If I might, it makes sense, the argument that a witness is useful to the case. That happens all the time, whether it's in mob cases or criminal cases involving Wall Street, which are going on, and in some cases, crimes that are much simpler than that, that are federal crimes. But the political influence part, it's really hard to see what kind of political influence a big Republican contributor like Bill Allen would have with the Democratic Justice Department.
And Eric Holder brought up the fact that he has done, in his words, some unpopular things in the Justice Department ranks, like throw out the case against Senator Ted Stevens. It was when the Obama administration came in and Eric Holder took his job, when he looked at that case and said, I'm throwing it out. I'm going to ask the judge to just get rid of this whole thing. And so he sort of asked Murkowski to, you know, have some faith in him in that respect. I think it's not so much that Bill Allen has ability to have connections in the Democratic White House or in the Justice Department. It's more his usefulness and the role he's been able to play. And some power that he may yield. But who knows? I mean, these are just the questions that Senator Murkowski is bringing up. And what she said was, there is this assumption that this wealthy guy, you know, with these good connections, could basically protect himself.
And
so Holder said no. Yeah. Murkowski said afterwards she was not really satisfied with his response, that she still has concerns and she plans to keep pressing it.
Thank you. Tony Hall violently swinging streetlights in Kotzebue came down, caused quite a stir, and proved to be a danger. What happened to Kotzebue when the lights went out?
Well, if you can imagine this, you're walking down the street with 34-foot light poles, weigh 270 pounds, and have 60-pound lamps. They start to sway. Lamps come crashing down to the ground. It'll make you look up in a whole different light, so to speak, after you hear this story. But that's what was happening in Kotzebue earlier, or in the middle of last month. The Northwest was hit by these huge blizzards, winds up to 60 miles an hour, and these lights that have been installed by DOT last September in this larger program to deal with erosion along the coast. Well received by the community up till the middle of February. They had a whalebone design, a kind of a slight curve, and these LED lights. The middle of last month, these LED lights started to sway with the blizzards, sway with the winds. A few of them came crashing down. A few of them sent their 60-pound lamps down to the street. At that point, the city and DOT decided we better close down Shore Avenue until we get this fixed. The problem.
This also, if I might, is a kind of classic story. The technology that works in Los Angeles doesn't work in fill-in-the-blank Alaska.
Yeah, well, this technology came from Omaha, so the state is going back to Omaha to try and figure out what happened. Right now, what they're suspecting is something called harmonic oscillation, which the writer of the story said that something you feel like you might hear in the opera.
Not to be confused with harmonic convergence.
That's right.
Okay, we're about out of time here on Anchorage Edition. We want to thank you for joining us, and we'll be right here next week with our show, Anchorage Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.